Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of the Speculist blog, and this show deals with all things futuristic, all things having to do with a bright future unfolding before us. And with me this evening is my co-blogger and co-speculist, El Jefe Grande himself, Mike Sargent. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Phil.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good, good. Well, we've got a lot of material that we need to cover this evening, but I think it would probably only be appropriate to just start out with a few quick words on the tragic events that have occurred in Colorado today. I don't think we should ignore that. Both up here in my part of the state and also down nearer to where you live.
A disappointing coincidence.
Has it been established actually at this point that it's a coincidence, or do we know for sure?
I haven't heard anything beyond the two that incidents might be related, at least on the local news.
Yeah, for those listening who don't know, there were two shootings today, apparently random shootings, both one at an actual church and one at a mission related to a church, one in the northern part of Denver and one in Colorado Springs. A terrible, tragic state of affairs. We're looking to get more information on that, and of course, our thoughts go out to the victims and to their families. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, so we will, having noted that, shift gears. And this is an unusual show we're doing tonight. We've done two-man shows before, obviously, with Stephen and myself, and you and Stephen have had a couple of outings, and this is the first time you and I have done it together, just the two of us. We don't have Stephen on the program with us, although he is here at least in spirit, if not in some other ways. So I guess we have no LSU news to report today.
Unfortunately.
Well, yeah.
We do, however, have the usual smattering of Denver sports news.
Well, I think we got a nice smattering today. You wanna give it away, or should I?
Was that smattering or splattering?
today it was a splattering in the right direction, absolutely.
It looks like the Broncos beat a longtime arch rival, the Kansas City Chiefs, in Kansas, 41-7.
41-7. I believe that was here in Invesco, though, actually.
Oh, my bad.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, we and that's twice we beat them this season, because we did beat them at Arrowhead last time we played them. So we've just owned them this season. But that was a beautiful game, 41-7. Just demolished them. This running back, now I can't think of his name. Well, as soon as I wanted to talk about him, of course, the name disappears from my head, but the MVP had a heck of a...
I did stop by the NFL website and take a look at the division standings, and what we actually had...
Now, why do you want to ruin it when we're having such a good time talking about this?
We had a 437 team beating a 333 team, so I don't think we should get out our playoff jerseys yet.
Yeah, you know, the big Rome foam rubber finger needs to stay in place for a while longer yet. Although I will say that had San Diego lost that game that they seemed certain to lose earlier today, things would be looking a little cheerier for us with that win. But then, you know, you can always do those what ifs. Selvin Young, that's the guy's name. I wanted to point out, had a fantastic day. Just a pleasure to watch him. And Jay Cutler looking pretty good too. Our quarterback running some interesting option plays. There fumbles the ball, picks it up, and runs for about 30 yards. That's kind of reminds me of the Elway days when you see that kind of action.
Classic Broncos play.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. You know, make lemonade. I think that's the philosophy of the Denver Broncos. So as I said, we got a lot of topics that we want to cover this evening. A little bit later on, our plan is to be bringing on Dr. Robert Zubrin, and we'll be talking with him about his book, Energy Victory, which should be a lot of fun, and some very interesting discussion. Before we get to that, though, let's note a couple of anniversaries that have either passed this weekend or, I don't know, might be occurring today. One that I had meant to mention on Friday when I did the latest Better All the Time, which we might get into Better All the Time a little bit as well this evening, was that Pearl Harbor Day was on Friday. And, you know, I went and put that date on there, December 7th, and posted the list of good news, and it never even occurred to me until later in the day that, that was Pearl Harbor Day. I really should have said something noting that day and remembering, you know, kind of the beginning, well, absolutely the beginning of the beginning of World War II, and just a very important day in our history, I suppose.
Absolutely, and the fact that no other attack by one government on another on American soil has taken place in the intervening period is probably the Better All the Time news to take away from that.
Yeah, well, that would have been hard to spin, you're right, into a Better All the Time. But I guess that's pretty good spin, actually. You've got it, Mike. You can do the spin doctoring to make it into good news. And there was another anniversary going on. Why don't you tell us about that one?
That we did, and this will be a little easier to spin in a positive sense.
Absolutely.
This last week was the anniversary of the repeal of a piece of legislation enacted in the 1920s, the Volstead Act. Do you know what the Volstead Act did?
The Volstead Act. Tell us about that.
The Volstead Act made it illegal to sell, transport, or buy spirituous liquors in the United States. It made alcohol illegal in the domain of the United States.
And that was prohibition.
That was prohibition, and according to one television program I watched this week, it cost the government some $500 million per year, and I don't know whether that was contemporary money or corrected for inflation. But even if it wasn't contemporary and it was corrected, that's a serious chunk of change.
Absolutely. So. In addition to what we would think of as all the social and fun benefits of the repeal of prohibition, there was actually a significant economic component involved.
Absolutely. Something we might be able to talk with Dr. Zubrin about a little later.
Well, I hope we're able to get into that. Now, I'm just seeing that I got a call here from the 303 area code, and I'm wondering if that might have been him trying to reach me. So what I'm going to do is I'm actually... Well, this is tricky. This never happens to the real guys on the radio. Let's see.
Never, ever. We never lose a commentator or a guest.
You know, I don't mean to put the whole world on hold here. I wish we had a pre-recorded.
Unfortunately, we can't cut to a commercial.
Yeah, I know, exactly. I don't have any pre-recorded stuff to play. Let me see if I can contact someone here and put him in touch with Dr. Zubrin. No, the one person I was going to try to reach is not there. So, there was another energy-related story having to do with biomass that you had mentioned in an email earlier. What's going on with that?
Well, briefly put, a company in England has recently put on the market a product called the Fuel Pod 2, and it's capability is to produce about 50 liters of biodiesel from recycled fryer grease,
mm-hmm.
In your garage automatically for the low price of £2,056, or roughly $4,000, give or take.
We'll call that $4,000. And what do you get for your money here exactly?
A stand in the corner unit, looks like a an electric vacuum machine, vacuum cleaner, or a shop vac.
Right.
Where you pour grease in one end and push the button, and out the other end comes biodiesel.
So, you know, I've heard of these kinds of setups before. What do you have to? Do you have to have anything in addition to the French fry grease in order to make biodiesel out of one of these things, or is it really that simple?
The process that I am most familiar with, and I'm not saying that that's exclusively the only way to do it.
Yeah.
But the standard process, if you will, combines methanol and caustic lye in a certain proportion with your used French fry grease filtered. The methanol and lye acts as a catalyst. It's not consumed in the reaction, but it actually converts the fatty acids in the French fry grease into something much, much more similar to pump diesel fuel.
Uh-huh.
So once you load this thing up with your chemical catalyst, it should run relatively unattended with just a little bit of electricity to provide heat to drive the reaction.
I see. Okay. So you have to get these catalysts, but by and large, if you can find a good source of French fry grease, you're able to fuel your vehicle with this device.
Correct. And about half of the French fry oil you put in comes out as biodiesel, and approximately the other half comes out as glycerol, or what we might know better as glycerin, a component of any number of things, but including hand lotions and other cosmetics. And worst comes to absolute worst, you can take this glycerin and dump it on the compost heap, and it's compostable.
So there you have it. So you can take, you can dump it on the compost heap and make compost, or you can use the compost to make your fuel?
You can dump it on the compost heap, and it contributes to the building of your compost, much like any other number of high-carbon components you can add to your compost.
Now, from a practical standpoint, I wonder how much of the source material grease is the average person likely to be able to get their hands on. Is this something that people can really make work and they can really fuel their vehicles off this kind of thing?
I would suppose that depends heavily on what kind of neighborhood you live in and how effective the food police have been in cleaning up your neighbor's attitudes toward French fries.
Right.
But given the fact that this machine will convert 50 liters, or about 13 gallons, and I, reading this material, it's a little hard to see whether that's input or output, but let's take it as output, 13 gallons output. So for one batch, you make roughly a tank full of fuel. And a friend of mine's driving from Pueblo to Colorado Springs on a daily basis, and he makes about 50 miles a gallon on his diesel fuel Jetta.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking roughly 515 or 520 miles worth of fuel out of 25, 26 gallons, or one good restaurant's worth, one change of oil at your local fast food restaurant.
Okay.
So if you strike up some friendships or manage to convince your local producer that you want one out of a week's worth of changes, I don't see where this would be too much of a drain on the resource, so to speak.
Right. Okay. So
not everybody could do it, but it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, it's something anyway. It's something. I've just gotten word from our guest that he is actually listening to the podcast right now, and I have emailed him the dial-in number. But if you're listening, that number is 347-215-8972. Need you to call that number, actually, to join the show. So hopefully he'll be on with us momentarily. So that's gets us to kind of where we're going with tonight's show, because if we talk about this development, biomass, which is going to give us, I guess this is methanol, is that right, or do you get ethanol out of the thing?
Out of this particular unit, you get biodiesel.
Biodiesel, okay, I'm sorry, excuse me. But I know they can be used, biomass can be used to make either ethanol or methanol. We've got the repeal of the Volkstead Act, and we've got Pearl Harbor, which is the anniversary of an attack on America, and all these topics kind of come together in terms of what we'll be talking with our guest about this evening, his book, Energy Victory. So hopefully he'll be joining us shortly, and we will commence to talking about that.
Actually, the book pretty much follows exactly that evolution in the chapters. The opening arguments are why we should move to biomass. The middle chapters are how, and the follow-up is back to some reasoning on why and how these kind of biomass fuels issues and fuels in general were the heart of the Second World War.
Absolutely, absolutely. Important important topic, and I think the idea that our energy policy could play such a critical role in defending our country as it did then, and as apparently it does now. Although, I guess right now he would argue that it's not actually the policies that we currently pursue, that is to say, aren't doing much to defend us. That they're in fact putting us at much greater risk, owing to the fact that by using foreign oil, by continuing to buy oil, particularly in the book he talks about Saudi Arabia, we provide money that ends up in the hands of terrorists and, in fact, enables and supports terrorist activities, the very activities that we're trying to bring an end to.
Absolutely. And on top of that, it's like any other situation where you have a limited number of producers. If you can only go to one guy, you are beholden to that individual for any number of things in addition to the product.
Right. So that is really the challenge area that we face today, and that's what again momentarily we hope to be getting into that. Meanwhile, I'll tell you what. While we wait for him to join us, why don't we step away from that and let's talk about a few of the other topics that we had lined up for potentially getting into this evening. I know we had said that we might want to just revisit pretty much everything that we had on our Better All the Time feature this week. And was there any of those, Mike, that struck you as particularly interesting? Anything that that kind of caught your fancy in terms of good news, technological developments that you'd like to mention?
Well, I'll definitely throw myself into the role of say that the article on tattoos as a replacement for injections struck me as very interesting.
That is interesting. I mentioned in writing that I'm a person who, because of a condition I have to take injections every day. And in fact, 3 days a week I have to take three injections. So I end up taking about, 13 injections every week. So the notion of eliminating some of that discomfort and some of that hassle associated with having to take injections is a very intriguing idea.
I will add my voice to that endorsement. I went through a period in my life where I was taking 3 to 4 injections a week, and not to put too fine a point on it, it was quite a pain, if you'll pardon the pun.
It is a pain. I mean, you know, physically, it's a hassle. I'm actually getting ready to leave on a business trip tomorrow. I'll be gone for 3 days, and one of the things that I do is I usually take my more significant round of injections on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. But it's like this week, it's such a hassle traveling with medication that I'm going to go ahead and take one batch tonight and take another batch on Thursday and only take the one thing that I have to take every day with me. Just because it's so much trouble getting medicine through security anymore. It's a hassle with these particular medications. You have to I always have to get a refrigerator in my room. So it's like, you know, it's one thing on top of another. It makes your life, it's one additional layer of complication in life, as if life wasn't complicated enough, having to manage something like that. And here, the development that they're talking about pretty much eliminates that.
And this new technology, how soon was this slated to potentially hit the market?
Well, I don't. Let me have a look here, because that's an excellent question, and I don't know if I got the time frame on there. As a matter of fact, I just got the method, but it was something that they're trialing now,
and with any luck, something that we'll be seeing in the very near future.
Now, for the moment, this technology is almost exclusively aimed at insulin-dependent diabetes, right?
That's right. But I would hasten to point out that as far as I read it, as far as I understand it, anything that's taken subcutaneously would work pretty much on the same principle. So if you're, I think the point here is that it's testing for the blood sugar levels and it's regulating that. So it's set up specifically for that. But any medication that that's taken subcutaneously could work the same way, and you could use one of these tattoos as a means of providing that that regular, I won't say injection, that regular dosage of that medicine. I would think intramuscular is going to be a little bit tougher of a nut to crack. I'm not sure that there will be a tattoo solution for that. I think we might have to wait for nanotechnology and Fantastic Voyage type stuff before, before people are able to find a really simple solution for that. All right, I was just checking. We're still waiting for our guest to join. He did notify that that he's listening. If you're still listening, let me give you that number one more time. The number is 347-215-8972. Actually, he's emailed me and says he's here, but I'm not seeing his number on the switchboard.
I can say from personal experience that the first time around this can be something of a challenge, but by comparison to all of the alternatives that aren't available, we've got a good thing going here on Blog Talk Radio.
Absolutely, we do. All right, now I see the number. Okay, it has appeared, and I'm going to hit that, and I believe we now have our guest with us. Hello, are you there?
I'm right here. I've been here for the past 10 minutes.
So sorry about that. The Blog Talk Radio switchboard only just brought your number up. Apologize for keeping you waiting on the line like that. Let me very quickly introduce our guest. We've got Dr. Robert Zubrin with us. He's the president of the Mars Society, which is an international organization that advocates a manned Mars mission as a goal by private funding if possible. He's also president of Pioneer Astronautics, a private company that does research and development on innovative aerospace technologies. He holds degrees in mathematics, aeronautics and astronautics, and nuclear engineering. And he's best known, perhaps, as an advocate for manned space exploration and settlement on the planet Mars. His proposed Mars Direct program, which outlined the fast way to get exploration and settlement of the Red Planet going, was the basis for his best-selling book, The Case for Mars. He's also the author of several other books, including his latest, which we've been talking about a little bit, entitled Energy Victory, and which we'll be getting into a little bit later starting right now. Dr. Robert Zubrin, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start out. Let's just get right into what the book is about. And let me just kind of take a stab at restating very shortly what your thesis is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong or expand if I get pretty close. So the idea that you outline here is that the effective way for us to win the war on terror is to cut off the funding for the terrorists, and that the effective way to do that is to get our country completely off foreign oil once and for all. And then I guess that the best way for us to do that is to start making cars that will burn methanol and ethanol in addition to gasoline.
Well, that's the general idea, but there's a couple of fine points to this that need to be emphasized. I'm not talking about getting our country off of foreign oil. I'm talking about breaking the oil cartel worldwide. Energy independence is an inadequate goal, because if the OPEC could destroy Japan's economy, for example, they'll still crash the international economy. And we have to force down the price of oil internationally, which once again cannot be done simply by taking the United States off of foreign oil. We have to attack the oil cartel internationally. And the way to do that is to put a mandate that all new cars sold in the United States, not made in the United States, sold in the United States, be flex fueled, which means able to run on either alcohol or gasoline. That would make flex fuel the international standard. It would force the Japanese car makers, for example, the Korean car makers, the European car makers, as well as the American car makers, to switch their lines over to flex fuel, which means that every car marketed internationally in the world would be able to run on either alcohol or gasoline, which means that gasoline would be forced to compete against alcohol at the pump everywhere in the world, not just in Kansas, but in Kenya, okay, and in India, everywhere. And that is how to destroy the vertical monopoly. You see, you know, they've raised the price of oil 60% this year. They've raised it a factor of 8 since 1999. Hugo Chavez is talking about sending the price up to $200 a barrel. And so long as they have a vertical monopoly, so long as the only thing that cars can run on internationally is the stuff that OPEC is producing, then they have the ability to run up the price. Okay. However, alcohol fuels, including both methanol and ethanol, conceivably others, are competitive against gasoline in the $50 a barrel range, which means that the current price is untenable, let alone further price increases, if we can put cars out there that can use the alternative fuel. Okay, so the way to destroy OPEC is to basically open the market. Right now we've got a closed market. We've got to bust the market open, okay? And it's going to take a government action to do that, but once we do that, we're really talking about a market-driven solution here. Now, as soon as you do that, Hugo Chavez is sunk. Venezuela cannot afford to sell oil at this point at $50 a barrel. Even Iran, which while it can produce oil for $15 a barrel, they have this huge state bureaucracy, a huge state budget that requires a massive infusion of petroleum money. And so once again, they're sunk. They would not be able to afford to meet payroll, let alone having a nuclear bomb program if you force the price of oil down to $50 a barrel. Now, the Saudis could survive oil at $50 a barrel, but it would really cramp their style a lot. It would greatly reduce the amount of funds they have available to support the propagation of terrorism internationally, which is what they have been doing. And and it would give them pause. It would make them start thinking about perhaps taking the 85% of their population that's on welfare off by actually developing some real economic development instead of just what they are now, which is a tyranny with an oil well and a state security apparatus attached, keeping their population on welfare so they can spend all their time in mosques getting brainwashed.
It's interesting. What you're talking about is less a technological solution and more a market solution to the problem. Is that right? I mean, there is technology involved because we're talking about changing the standard by which regular automobiles operate. But that seems almost secondary to the real goal here, which is to get in and compete with oil by providing
right.
something that can.
Once we open the market, then technology will mobilize. Then, for example, once you have this $2 trillion market opened up to alternatives, you'll find billions of dollars of R&D money mobilized into, for example, developing cellulosic ethanol, which would vastly expand the ethanol supply, or developing catalytic ways of producing ethanol from synthesis gas, which would allow us to produce it the same way we can make from methanol, which is from virtually any carbonaceous material ranging from any kind of biomass whatsoever to urban trash as well as coal and natural gas. If we can open the market, there's technology now that can meet it and meet the price of $50 a barrel, and with the market opened, human ingenuity will drive the price down well below $50 a barrel. That's the thing. Because, I mean, look, coal right now sells for 3 cents a kilogram, which a gallon of gasoline weighs 3 kilograms, which is, if you could turn coal into gasoline or into alcohol that is equivalent to gasoline, you'd be basically producing gasoline at 9 or 10 cents a gallon plus in raw materials costs, plus the other costs. If we open the market, the technology exists right now to drive the oil price down to $50, and we can drive it a lot further than that once the technology advancement gets moving.
What about that idea of using coal to create a liquid fuel? We have plenty of coal, and it has been done in the past, I believe. In World War II, they used coal to make liquid fuel. Could we do that?
Well,
or why is alcohol a better
that.
Solution?
Okay, because alcohols are much easier to make than gasoline. If you see, what's called synthesis gas is a mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen. And you can make synthesis gas from any carbonaceous material whatsoever, okay, including any kind of biomass, as well as coal, natural gas, urban trash, what have you. Now, right now, the only fuel you can make easily from synthesis gas is methanol. Okay?
Okay.
And, well, methanol is an alcohol. Methanol will run in flex fuel cars. So if we put a sufficient number of flex fuel cars on the road out there that people are willing to set up pumps to serve them, see, right now there's not enough. Right? I mean, the reason why there's only 700 E85 pumps in the whole United States out of 200,000 gas stations is because if you've got a 7-Eleven and you own three pumps, you're not going to dedicate one of them to a kind of fuel that only 2% of the cars can use. Okay? But if we had a mandate that all cars sold in this country had to be flex-fueled within 3 years, we'd have 50 million cars on the road here capable of running on methanol or ethanol. And then you'd see E85 and M85 pumps going up all over the place. And that would really pin OPEC's ears right back to their head. And that would be going on everywhere in the world, which is the point. Yes, if necessary, we can make it out of coal. Now, which would immediately give the United States energy security in the strategic sense. For economic security, though, what we need is the whole world to not be subject to blackmail from OPEC. And this is how you could do it. Now, if you want to address, for instance, certain additional problems besides the strategic ones, such as global warming, then making your alcohol from coal is not desirable. You would prefer to make it from biomass or from urban trash, which is going to decay into CO2 if it's left to its own devices, or from stranded natural gas, which is how most methanol today is made, which is to say natural gas that otherwise is just going to be flared. And then your alcohol economy is acting very much to counter global warming. And so we can have worldwide economic expansion and counter global warming at the same time. We don't need mandates suppressing our economy to stop global warming. What we need to do is bust the oil cartel and put us on the alcohol standard. Okay, and if we do that, by the way, it'd be tremendously beneficial not just to us, but even more so to the poorer countries of the world, the third world, because the high oil price that the Saudis and Mr. Chavez want to introduce and have been pushing is a tremendous regressive tax against the world's poor. I mean, it's one thing for people in America to pay $100 a barrel for oil. It's another thing for people in Somalia who make $2 a day to pay $100 a barrel for oil. It means that a farmer can't get his crop to market because he can't pay for the gas.
Now, is there a distinction between the what $100 per barrel turns into in terms of price per gallon versus what it finally becomes by the time we pay for it at the pump, or I would think even worse yet, what the European Union pays for it at the pump because of all the taxes that are added to the gas? How big of a factor is that?
Well, the taxes in Europe are much higher, which is why they're paying like $8 a gallon for gas right now.
Right.
In the United States, obviously there is taxes, which depending upon which state you're in, might run 50 or 60 cents a gallon. The $100 a barrel is eventually going to translate into gas in like the $3.50 range, which
okay.
We're already beginning to see.
Right.
$200 is going to be a lot more.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
Can I jump in here and
sure.
Turn us back to the regressive nature of expensive oil?
Yeah.
in a nutshell, the quick, simple, cheap, and easy way to get to an alcohol economy is by way of ethanol. Would you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that. I think both ethanol and methanol should be pursued.
Should they be pursued? Which one is the easier one for the peasant in the country to access?
It depends what country. The methanol can be made from methanol at this point represents a broader based resource because it can be made from any kind of plant material whatsoever. Now, it's an inferior fuel to ethanol. Ethanol has more energy per gallon than methanol. But the things that ethanol has to be made out of right now are basically starches and sugars being fermented. That puts a certain floor price under what ethanol can cost, and it also restricts the resource base. Now, I think that, in fact, if we open up the market in this way, we're going to see money going into developing cellulosic ethanol and resolving the technical issues there, as well as ethanol produced by inorganic catalysis, at which point ethanol will be producible from as many or almost as many feedstocks as methanol. So,
I'll grant that the breadth of feedstocks is definitely in favor of methanol, but from a low-tech standpoint, it doesn't get much harder than a boiling pot and a chilled saucer over the top of it to make what is essentially fuel-grade ethanol from whatever you might have on hand in terms of surplus starch and or sugar.
Well, there's some truth to that, and also, you know, in a lot of countries, there's a great deal of crops that, for instance, if they're rotting, if they don't make it to market, if they're still perfectly good for making ethanol out of, even though they're no longer considered saleable as food. So there's a lot of foodstuff material that could be turned to ethanol at no cost to the food supply. So there's some truth to that, but the point is, you see, is that the flex fuel car can use either methanol or ethanol. The flex fuel cars were actually originally developed for methanol. They were only recertified for ethanol later. And the what I want is to put the flex fuel cars out there and then let the market decide. Indeed, in some places, if it's much easier to make ethanol, by God, let them make ethanol.
Okay, let's talk a little about those flex fuel cars. First, let me say you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Dr. Robert Zubrin about his book, Energy Victory. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a question for Dr. Zubrin, you can call us at 347-215-8972. So looking at these flex fuel cars, my first question would be, how does it open up the energy market worldwide if, in the U.S., we have a law that says the cars have to be flex fuel?
Because all the foreign automakers are going to turn their whole lines over. No one's going to walk away from the American market. It's a situation somewhat analogous. You know how California can sometimes move the whole American industry by passing some regulation because they don't want to write off California as a market. It's too big. Well, the United States economy has the same relationship to the world economy. I mean, nobody's about to walk away from the American market. If we make a regulation here that cars have to be flex-fueled if they're going to be sold here, everybody's just going to convert their lines over.
So they'll make all their cars flex-fuel, not just make some flex-fuel for the U.S.?
Right.
Okay.
And Zubrin, would you consider an addition to the policy some kind of incentive to convert existing compatible cars to flex fuel?
I think that we do want, there's a variety of kits being marketed on the internet right now to convert existing cars to flex fuel. The problem is nobody knows which are good and which are not. I think having a federal agency or else an industry group give out certification so that someone could look at this and say, okay, this one has been certified either by the feds or by the Better Automobile Association, whatever, okay, and they'd have some guarantee that they were getting a good product. That would be a very positive development. Now, it's much cheaper to make them flex fuel in the first place. It only adds about $100 to the cost of the car to manufacture.
For the record, I was looking at it for one of my vehicles, and the conversion cost is about $350.
Right.
And that's for a car you already have. It would cost about $300, you said?
Correct.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, but the problem is people look at these kits, and they don't know what they're getting into, and that's a thing. If we could have some form of certification, then indeed we could then a lot of people would probably want to convert.
But one of my questions about this was going to be cost, and it sounds like if this is a conversion you can make for a few hundred dollars to an existing car, then if a automobile manufacturer were to adopt this as their standard practice, it would scale and the cost would not be tremendous.
Well, the cost right now is not tremendous. In other words, right now this year Detroit is producing around 24 different models of cars that are flex-fueled, and they only cost about $100 more than the same car in non-flex-fuel form. Okay, because the only difference is the programming of the electronic fuel injector and the materials used in the fuel line.
Right.
Which at the difference in pump price, at least at my E85 pump just over the hill, is about 100 gallons or 150 gallons worth of price difference to pay for the conversion or the initial investment.
Right. And so unlike a hybrid, which takes you years to earn back the difference in cost, this is something that you earn it back in months and at most. But not only that, you see, by mandating that all the cars be flex-fueled, you put a critical mass of flex-fuel cars out there, which would give the station owners the incentive to put up alcohol pumps. You see, right now, there's no real upside in general to owning a flex-fuel car because you can't find an E85 pump anyway, unless in some states in the Midwest where the state governments have subsidized them because of the farm lobby. But if we had this mandate, as I say, within 3 years, a third of the cars that are actively being driven would be capable of using alcohol fuels, and those alcohol fuels would come up. Those pumps would be put up. They'd be there. And then there would be an increased incentive for people with existing cars to convert them, and or for people to buy new cars that were flex-fueled from the get-go.
Dr. Rubin, we're getting a question in the chat room. Perhaps you can address it. Maybe you'd like to throw it out to any experts that might be listening. Guest 821 is asking us, what's the time frame for cellulosic ethanol coming to market? Do you have any research that points in that direction?
Well, cellulosic ethanol, it looks like we'll probably be seeing cellulosic ethanol in at this point in 4 or 5 years or something. I think if we had a flex fuel mandate, that would greatly accelerate it. It would, and it would greatly increase the stakes on for the benefit of developing cellulosic ethanol.
So, if Detroit is already making flex fuel cars, and there's bound to be a push for it from the farm lobby, what's the biggest hindrance to rolling out a program like what you're talking about doing? What would stop
Well, there, as documented in the book Energy Victory, there is a massive amount of Saudi money playing in Washington right now. They have been feeding money into most of the major think tanks that give the politicians their ideas, and this is why we see all these diatribes against ethanol being put out by supposed free market economists. Not mentioning a word about the much larger subsidies for oil. This is, the think tanks, the politicians themselves. Here you have the Saudis. I mean, just to give you an example. Okay, this goes beyond energy policy. This gets into foreign policy. All right. They are propagandizing their people and Muslims all over the world to kill Americans, okay? Here's a sample of some of the stuff put out in Saudi government publications. This is from Al Watan, official Saudi Arabian newspaper, okay, talking about, this is from December 2004, discussing the activities of the American troops in Iraq. Here's what they say about our soldiers. Okay, they say, a secret team of American physicians follows the troops during their attacks to ensure quick operations for extracting some organs and transferring them to private operation rooms before they are transported to America for sale. These teams offer $40 for every usable kidney and $25 for an eye. Okay? That's what they are saying about us. That is why the majority of foreign fighters coming into Iraq to blow up pet markets and attack our soldiers and create murder and mayhem of every type are Saudis, and the rest are Arabs who've been propagandized by the Saudis. Now, you would think that this going on, this massive, rabid incitement against us, would cause a protest from the U.S. State Department, and it doesn't. Okay, well, guess what? Okay, Colin Powell was Secretary of State when that article was published in 2004. A week after he retired as Secretary of State, Colin Powell answers his front door, and there's Prince Bandar with the keys to a new Jaguar that he gives him. Now, that gift was legal, okay, because it was given to Mr. Powell a week after he retired as Secretary of State. Okay, so it was not technically a bribe. However,
well, plus, according to your book, they were just good old racquetball buddies, right? Isn't that?
Yes, that's right. Okay, but as Prince Bandar explained to the Washington Post, well, if word gets around how good the Saudis are to their friends after they leave office, you'd be amazed how much more friendly while they're in office. Okay, now here's Spencer Abraham, who was George Bush's Secretary of Energy during his first term and was actively involved in pushing the hydrogen hoax, which is a completely fake solution to the energy problem, as discussed in Energy Victory. He is now a paid lobbyist, okay, for Saudi Arabia. Patton Boggs, the largest lobbying law firm in Washington, D.C., with 400 lawyers on staff, is registered with the U.S. Department of Justice as an agent of the Saudi Arabian government. Akin Gump, a leading Democratic Party law firm, the Vernon Jordan is its head, very influential in the Clinton administration. Okay, they've taken Saudi money. James Baker III, who wrote the Iraq report of very prominent a year ago and recommending things of how to deal with Iraq, his law firm just got $4 million from the Saudi royal family to defend them against the claims of the families of the 9/11 victims. Okay, and you know, guess what's not in the Baker Hamilton report? Is any idea that the United States should pressure the Saudis into stopping urging Arabs everywhere to kill us? Okay, so is it any surprise with this going on that we don't have a competent energy policy and haven't had one for a third of a century, ever since 1973 when the Saudis made it clear that they were not our allies?
So when we read, and I do see quite a bit of critical stuff about ethanol on the web, the more I think about it, it seems to me that when the subject comes up in these forums, it's generally dismissed for a number of different reasons. And your point is that those arguments are actually, in some sense, financed by the Saudis, that is...
Well, either by them or by the oil companies, which have a parallel interest in wanting to keep the price of oil high.
Right.
Yeah.
What about this argument that... That ethanol is driving up the price of corn and that people are going to be going hungry in Latin America?
Okay. The price of food is going up internationally because of increased demand from China and India right now, okay, as well as because of increased costs in the price of fuel. That has driven up the price of fish, for example, which do not eat corn. Look, okay, I mean, it's really funny, okay, because when I was circulating the manuscript for this book, and I circulated it to an editor at one of the more liberal publishing houses, he reacted with horror, saying, oh, this book, I mean, how cruel can you be wanting to take away all this money from the Arabs? What will they do after that? You know, you'll make them all poor. That's, you know, such a vicious thing that you want to do. Well, let's look at this for a minute, okay? In 2006, Saudi Arabia, with a population of 24 million people, one in six of whom work, okay, pulled in $200 billion in oil revenues. Simultaneously, in the same year, Kenya, with a population of 36 million, the majority of whom work, Okay, pulled in $2.5 billion in foreign exchange from exports of all types, much of which they had to pay for overpriced oil imports. Okay, so distributed elsewhere, the foreign exchange earnings of Saudi Arabia could double the foreign exchange earnings of 80 countries the size of Kenya. Okay, and Kenya, by the way, is not a particularly poor country, among third world countries. It's not one of the 50 poorest countries in the world, for example. It's a sort of a run-of-the-mill, average, everyday third world country. Now, when you transfer this money, okay, from the oil cartel to tropical agricultural countries, do you think you're going to be helping those people or hurting those people? You think they're better off having the money go to Saudi Arabia or having them go to agriculture and industry in their own country? Because, by the way, this also means industrial development. You're not going to be shipping biomass from these countries overseas. You'll be transforming it into methanol or ethanol right there, and if you want, and part of it will be used there and the other part will be exported. Because that's another point here. You see, if we had this flex fuel mandate, there would be a larger market for agricultural crops here in the United States than American farmers could produce to, no matter how hard they try. That is a good thing, okay? That means we could give the American farmers all the business they can handle, and we'd have business left over to give, for instance, to Latin America. Right now, you know, we're tariffing Brazilian ethanol to keep it out of the country. Okay, because the ethanol program right now is not being run as a serious energy security initiative. It's being run largely as a subsidy for the farmers, and they don't want any foreign ethanol coming in. If we expanded the market in the way that I'm proposing, the American farmers would be able to sell every gallon of ethanol they could make, and there'd still be room for ethanol made in Haiti and Jamaica and Brazil and Colombia and all these places, and the same with Europe vis-a-vis Africa and Japan vis-a-vis Southeast Asia. Okay, we're talking about taking about $1 trillion a year that is now going to the oil cartel and switching it over to the world's farmers instead. About half perhaps going to advanced sector farmers, the other half going to the third world. This would be a tremendous engine for world development. It'd be a tremendous humanitarian act.
So how do we make it happen? What if people are listening to this right now and they think this mandate sounds like a great idea? What's the next step? What should people do? What will overcome this environment of resistance?
What they have to do is approach the political camps. Who, you know, if they're conservatives, approach the conservatives that are running for president. If they're liberals, approach the liberals who are running for president, and say, will you support a flexible mandate? Will you call for it? Okay, you know, I mean, because look, after all, in whose interest is it that the cars not be flex-fueled? It's only in the interest of the oil cartel. So this is really a question of which side are they on. You know, I put out this thesis first in a magazine article a year ago, and it was read by John Marburger, who's President Bush's science advisor. And he emailed me a bunch of detailed questions, and I answered them, and then I said, okay, why not do it? If President Bush called for this, he'd get bipartisan support. I mean, here's Nancy Pelosi is a big supporter of biofuels. There'd be lots of Democratic support. This bill would pass. It would be an enormous accomplishment for the administration, an enormous accomplishment for America, enormous accomplishment for the West in general. And so he answers me. He says, well, we don't believe in mandates. And then I have a meeting with one of his staff scientists, a PhD. He met with me for 3 hours. He was a very intelligent man. And I said, look, why not do this? This won't cost the Treasury a nickel. He says, what are you talking about? This won't cost the Treasury a nickel. This would cost a lot of money. I said, what are you talking about? He says, each of the car engine types that have to be turned into flex fuel, it would cost $1 million to recertify them. Each one. I said, how many different engine types are there between the big three? He says, 150. So that's $150 million. Okay, where are we going to find that money? I said, what are you talking about? That's the amount we spend on foreign oil in 3 hours.
Wow.
In this country, okay? So, in other words, here's the Bush administration making excuses because they're in with the Saudis and they're in with big oil. Who's Hillary Clinton in with? Who's Barack Obama in with? Who's John McCain in with? Who's Giuliani in with? Who's Huckabee in with? This is the question that each person listening to this has got to ask their candidate, okay? And say, look, this is, you know, what you need to come out for, okay? You know, otherwise, there's no reason why you should be president. I mean, maybe you should run for president of Saudi Arabia, but not this country.
Well, based on reading your book, though, it seems like everybody's in with the Saudis. I mean, the dealers are pretty long, aren't they? Or
there's a lot of Saudi influence being peddled around, but you know, Mr. Huckabee has a choice, Mrs. Clinton has a choice, Mr. Obama has a choice, Mr. McCain has a choice. Okay, they can decide to continue this intolerable situation, or they can do something else. You know, up till now, everybody's just been going with the flow, okay, accepting the status quo. But look where this has gotten us. In 1972, the United States paid $4 billion for oil imports. Last year, it was $260 billion. It's gone up a factor of 60, okay? And if the oil price remains at $100 a barrel, next year, it'll be $400 billion. The amount we paid for oil imports in 1972 equaled 1.2% of our defense budget of that year. The amount we paid last year was half of our defense budget, okay? And the money went right over to the other side, okay? The Saudis, over the same period, went from $2.7 billion in oil earnings in 1972 to $200 billion last year. It's going to be close to $300 billion this year. I mean, we're literally right now funding both sides in the war on terror with comparable amounts of money. And soon, we'll be paying more to the other side than we pay to our own Defense Department.
And we'll be, when you say that, it's important to clarify, you mean by way of purchasing oil. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
how we do it. So on the one hand, we're putting troops in the field, and on the other hand, we're buying oil that eventually ends up putting troops in the field.
The
other guys.
That's right.
The side we're fighting. Amazing stuff.
Right. And it's all documented in Energy Victory. The book extensively documents how the Saudis have been using their revenues to finance terrorism, how they have set up over 20,000 madrasas around the world, not counting those inside of Saudi Arabia, how they set up over 1,000 in Pakistan alone. That's how they created the Taliban, but how they're running Islamist fundamentalist insurgencies and jihads everywhere from Biafra in Nigeria, where they're killing Christians, to Algeria, where they're killing secular Muslims. Egypt, they killed Anwar Sadat. Israel, of course, terrorism all the time. Okay, Iraq, where they're killing us as well as Shiites. Former Soviet Central Asia, where they're killing ethnic Russians. India, where they're killing Hindus. And Thailand and Indonesia, where their horrific campaigns against Buddhists are going on, Philippines against Catholics, of course, 9/11 in this country, the Sudan, okay, where they were behind the genocide against the Christians and animists in the south before and against the black non-Muslim fundamentalist Muslims in Darfur now.
With only about a minute left, we have a question from the chat room. What is the main question, or maybe this is what is the first question, that we should be asking the candidates, and I presume this means for president, in terms of sussing up how effective they're going to be on this issue?
Well, you should ask them, will you support a mandate to make all cars sold in this country flex-fueled and break the international oil cartel? Or will you allow this situation to continue, allow Mr. Chavez to get his $200 a barrel oil, allow Saudi oil revenues to go to $500 billion a year, allow them to loot our economy, loot other economies, commit genocide against the third world, essentially through destroying their economies in this way, you know, or will they fight back? Which side are they on?
Okay. That's a very straightforward question, and that's the question that I think I'd like to hear answered. Actually, I'd like to hear any direct kind of question like that at one of these debates, but that would be an excellent one indeed. The time went by much quicker than we had thought that it would. We'd very much like to have you back on the show again. There's other things we would like to discuss with you, but let me just say once again, the book is called Energy Victory. We do have links for that book up on speculus.com. And Dr. Robert Zubrin, thank you so much for your time this evening.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
All right. Well, Mike, that just about takes us to the end of the show. It's too bad we had a little bit of technical difficulties there at the beginning, but we did did manage to take the full half hour for the interview.
What a fantastic interview that was, too. And I would definitely look forward to hearing from Dr. Zubrin again.
As would I. We just scratched the surface on this, and it was really generating some interesting
discussion in the chat room. I think it probably will on the blog as well. Look forward to seeing some further discussion of these issues down the road.
Me too.
Well, time is up. Stephen has lined us up with a very interesting closing music for this evening. I don't know if you saw the emails on that, but the artist for our closing music this evening is actually Duran Duran.
So, a little flashback, just back to the early 80s and
the 80s, yeah. But this is not pirated music. They're using the same site that Stephen uses to bring up these independent artists that we often play. And now Duran Duran itself, trying to get back in the limelight a little bit, has put a song up there, and their song is called "Falling Down." So we're going to take a listen to that. And Mike, thanks so much for filling in for Stephen tonight. It was great having you on the program.
Thank you.
And we will look forward to talking with you all once again on the next Fast Forward Radio.
Play.